It's season 5 of Naturally Educated. Hello and welcome once again. My name is Abdurrahman Al-Zaabi, and with me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Tim Elliott. All is well, Tim?
Abdurrahman, not at all bad, thanks. Good to be back with you again. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm doing fine. I'm a little bit concerned, let's say. And, you know, a lot of people tell me when it's cold in the winter, they say, you know, climate change, it's not there. I don't feel it. It's cold. I'm wearing my jacket. And then similarly, when it's hot in the summer, they say, well, I don't know about climate change. You know, it's not convincing. It was hot last year, etc. And that kind of like got me worked up, let's say.
Okay. I can kind of appreciate that because I have this argument with my dad a lot, and his argument is always, well, it's just weather. And I try to make the distinction that climate change is different to weather patterns, Dad. But it's a hard thing to get across. So I feel your pain.
It's definitely, and the misinformation out there is ridiculous. I hope that, you know, using our voices, we can sort of drive the correct information out there. We're now well into season 5 of Naturally Educated. And this time we're all about highlighting the role of biodiversity, technology, and sustainable practices in restoring degraded ecosystems. Plus, with the IUCN World Conservation Congress in Abu Dhabi this year, I feel like it's time to make some noise. You know what I mean?
I do.
Well, I have a little bit of a surprise for you. I think we should turn it up a notch. Let me just pick up my megaphone here. Here's the topic for today. You ready for this?
Sure.
A global call to restore and renew ecosystems.
Nicely done, Abdurrahman. I hear you loud and clear, and I'm with you.
Well, that's good to hear. No, but seriously, all right. Sometimes you just have to shout it out from the rooftops, all right? People need to listen to this, Tim. The simple fact is that biodiversity of our ecosystems is really under threat. We lose species every day because of what we do and the way we live. Climate change and pollution is such a serious issue.
It is. And it's really these things that this kind of global call is trying to address first. The ecosystems that help, you know, regulate the climate are under threat. And the places that we and the plants, the animals, organisms that we share the planet with live, whether it's forests, grasslands, wetlands, oceans, deserts, whatever, you know, your place of life is.
That's it. There is like a real need to conserve what we have and to do what we can to reverse the damage we've already done. The good news is, and you know, excuse my emotions here with this topic, but and I want to sort of share that with you as well. The good news is that efforts are underway from reforestation in the Amazon in Africa to coral reforestation here in the UAE, which we're very proud of. We're seeing success stories around the world. And the even better news is that if we keep making a concerted effort to restore and sustain our ecosystems, we'll be doing our best to secure a sustainable, thriving future. Sounds straightforward, doesn't it?
Sounds straightforward, but the word global in the title makes me, well, you know, that's the giveaway.
Exactly, and that's the point, Tim. It's about so much more than you and me and our nearest and dearest. It's about us all.
I'm kind of getting a bit swept along with you. I can feel the emotions running here.
Forgive me, Tim. It's just that this is a topic that means a great deal to me. I see it as so important. I feel like it's actually quite easy to be better, and being better is a good way to be.
So to be the best versions, I guess, of ourselves, really. Think about how we live, think about where we live and the people and the things we live with. That's really what you're trying to say?
That's it, Tim. The potential for positive change is huge. The point is that ecosystem restoration is not just a necessity. It's a call to action. It's a global call for us all. All right. And that's my rant. Over.
So that's why this episode is particularly important to Abdurrahman, but it's obviously really important for us all. So you're set, Abdurrahman?
I am ready.
Okay. A global call to restore and renew ecosystems. That's the title. 3, 2, 1.
Our guest today is an expert from EAD, Abu Dhabi's Environment Agency. She's an expert within the marine team at EAD working on mangrove restoration. Nisreen Zahlawi, a warm welcome to Naturally Educated.
Thank you, Abdulrahman. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is all ours. Nisreen, let's jump right in. Tell us about who Nisreen is, your area of expertise, and what do you do now at EAD?
Sure. So I'm an aquatic ecologist with about 17 years of career experience working in biodiversity conservation and policies. So I've been with EAD for about 11 years. And in my previous role at EAD, I was part of a team that worked on developing evidence-based biodiversity policies and strategies. And that was a really fascinating role that helped me make that connection between science, policy, and especially policy communication to decision makers and to the public. And recently, about 2-3 years ago, I moved to the amazing marine habitat conservation and restoration team at EAD. And I've been working specifically on leading the setup of a program called the Abu Dhabi Mangrove Initiative, which really aims to develop Abu Dhabi as a center of excellence for the region and the world in mangrove restoration, science, and conservation.
Nisreen, we love mangroves on this show, as you probably know. I know you've heard a few of our episodes. Abdulrahman backing me up there. We'll come to mangroves a little bit later. I wanted to take you back a bit. I know we've caught you at home. I know you're busy. We've had to kind of schedule an hour in between times with you. But I wanted to take you back and ask you, why did you follow the kind of environmental ecosystem path? Where did you catch the bug, as it were?
So yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I think it really comes down to our experiences in life that have influenced us. And I've always had an interest in biology and natural sciences. And initially I thought, okay, I'll go into the medical science. I'll go into either medical, biomedical engineering or genetics or even medicine. And then when I was at university, I took one kind of optional class in environmental science or ecosystems biology. And we had this really passionate professor who took us out snorkeling at a coral reef site. And this is where my eyes opened up and, you know, I thought, okay, there's more to biology and natural science than just human biology. but also partially because my family, a lot during the summers that we spent in Syria, so I'm originally Syrian, we spent it in a city along the Syrian coast in the north. And we went every summer to this village along the coast, close to the beach. And there was no internet, no TV, nothing to do except go out to the beach and kind of explore and spend time there. And this is where I got this real attachment and interest to the ocean and to the sea. And I guess as during my university days, influenced or inspired by these few professors that I had in ichthyology, which is fish sciences, and also marine ecology, that's when I said, okay, environmental science is the way to go for me. And I specialized in environmental biology and ecosystems. Even though it is, I have to say, a difficult career path to choose because there are unfortunately limited or maybe there's this perception that there are limited career opportunities. But in reality, there's a huge demand for marine scientists, for environmental scientists, for people that are interested in conservation and biodiversity, because really our planet is facing a crisis and we need more professionals, multidisciplinary professionals in this field.
We really do. And it's also, it's a nice thing to hear when somebody kind of says, you know, basically, I do for my living what I did and liked as a child. It's a great way to kind of work your way through life, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a combination of, so you need a passion and you need interest, but also hard work and dedication. So it's something, it's this passion and interest that drives the effort and the hard work needed to make it happen.
Indeed. And, you know, from my experience, my limited experience, that's where good things can happen, you know. It's kind of the right driver to bring about change. So, Nasreen, let's get right into it. There are three areas I'd like to get your perspective on, namely biodiversity, climate change, and pollution. These areas, very broadly, to sort of reverse damage, the damage done to secure a sustainable, thriving future, and how to restore and sustain our ecosystems, in particular in the UAE.
Yes, so in the UAE, we're blessed to have very unique marine and terrestrial ecosystems that are already very resilient to harsh conditions, extreme environmental conditions. So you have extremely high temperatures in the summer, dry conditions, but also for marine habitats in particular, very cold conditions compared to tropical ecosystems. And so we're lucky to have this kind of open laboratory for climate change scenarios in right here at our doorstep. So it allows us to study them, understand what gives them this resilience, what are the genetic differences in the species and ecosystems that we see here that might advise or provide us with insight into what might happen in other parts of the world. And, you know, now that we're facing this triple planetary crisis of, as you rightly said, climate change, biodiversity loss, and pollution, it's important to identify solutions that will together help us address these three crises together. At EAD, I think the most important thing that has been prioritized since really EAD was established more than 25 years ago is having the data to guide us on what actions would result in impactful and measurable change. So you need those surveys, scientific surveys, assessments to be done over a long period of time to collect the information that is giving us insight into what's happening really within these ecosystems. How is climate change affecting them? When we talk about pollution, what are the sources of pollution, point and non-point sources? And what are the key measures that will help us, you know, address those sources of pollution? And when it comes to climate change, we've been particularly focused on the concept of nature-based solutions. So these are solutions basically that are already there, existing in nature, where habitats are helping us to sequester carbon. They're helping us to enhance our resilience to climate change, protect, for example, by minimizing coastal erosion, ensuring that our coasts are stabilized. And this is something especially true for mangrove, seagrass, and salt marsh ecosystems that Abu Dhabi and the UAE are blessed with, and in particular Abu Dhabi. So marine coastal ecosystems in the UAE and in Abu Dhabi in particular are immensely valuable when we think of the triple planetary crisis of climate change, biodiversity loss, and pollution. For example, mangroves are incredible nature-based solutions to climate change. They play different roles in helping us adapt and mitigate climate change impacts. They store carbon within mangrove soils by trapping sediments that get trapped within their roots, but they're also havens for biodiversity. In terms of pollution, they've been known as well to help recycle nutrients and purify seawater. So you have a natural ecosystem that is already naturally able to address these three challenges, human challenges that we're facing, biodiversity loss, pollution, and climate change, by simply preserving mangroves, protecting them, ensuring that they are well preserved, sustained within and without protected areas, and that they are well restored. That's already a big contribution, helping us address these challenges. Seagrass beds, in particular, the largest marine coastal ecosystem that we have in Abu Dhabi Emirates are seagrass meadows. They're the lesser known amazing blue carbon habitat that we have that is a very powerful nature-based solution as well. So seagrass beds also sequester carbon within marine sediments. And a paper a few years ago in Nature helped to showcase that they also remove bacteria, microbial pathogens from the water significantly. So you have this natural filter of seawater. And that's hugely important when you consider that we are completely reliant on seawater for our water source, because most of our water comes from desalination. So you have very powerful natural marine and coastal ecosystems that are helping us remove pollutants and contaminants from our waters that are helping us sequester carbon, but are also important havens for our native species. We're talking, you know, important habitats for juvenile fish, multiple species of crabs, resident and migratory shorebirds that rely on these habitats for feeding and roosting, as well as a wide array of invertebrate and insect biodiversity that we are still studying.
You know what that recalls to me? It's that moment in Jurassic Park when Jeff Goldblum says, "Nature will find a way." And these natural solutions clearly are the way forward, but there is pressure on ecosystems, in particular through climate change. I wanted to kick back to biodiversity, Nasreen. The UN has called the ongoing decline of biodiversity the sixth mass extinction. There are some fairly dire warnings. We could lose millions of species in the coming decades, whether it's terrestrial, whether it's marine or freshwater ecosystems. Losing species means the foundations of their health begins to break down. So could I get you to kind of simplify that, Bruce, put that into some perspective for the layman listening?
The health of our ecosystems and our biodiversity and human health are interlinked. And the important thing to understand is that, you know, healthy habitats and ecosystems play an important role in regulating our climate, but also regulating kind of the function of ecosystems and habitats that help maintain these species. So in order to preserve ecosystem health and biodiversity health, we have to ensure that these habitats can continue to function. So as one example, coral reefs are incredibly important. What we've found is that when you have coastal ecosystems that are well-maintained and healthy, that are well-connected as well, so when you have seagrasses, coral, and mangroves in one seascape, and when they are well-preserved, then each ecosystem is supporting one another. So a healthy mangrove is usually found nearby a healthy seagrass bed, which is usually found nearby a healthy coral system. So there's still a lot that we still need to study and understand about the importance of this connectivity and how it impacts the health and abundance of species. But what many studies have shown, and also what our observations have shown in Abu Dhabi, is that when you have these healthy integrated seascape that is well connected, this supports an abundance of it's kind of an insurance policy for species, where at different life cycles, these animals, be it fish, invertebrates, they move at different life stages to different habitats. And when you have habitats that are healthy and interconnected, this is where the health and continuation and where the populations of these species can be sustained. And in turn, I think I need to connect it to human well-being. So it's sometimes it's really difficult for people to make that connection between human health and the health of our environment. It's not just about, you know, filtering pollutants from seawater or purifying our air, but also about this natural cycle that ensures that there is a balance in the natural environment, and also that these areas, these habitats, help to ensure that any harmful pathogens, be it to human, be it to species, wildlife in particular, are under control. So whenever there's an imbalance in an ecosystem due to a habitat being impacted or a keystone species in an ecosystem being removed, this is where we see the emergence of diseases. And this is where we see sometimes when there's human and wildlife conflict, or when humans are encroaching too closely on wild habitats, this is where we see the emergence of zoonotic diseases, or diseases that can be transferred from wildlife to humans. And by maintaining these buffer zones or these natural ecosystems, by maintaining these habitats and ensuring, you know, that there is some distance between human settlements or human activities and natural ecosystems, you make sure that, you know, these pathogens cannot easily be transmitted, but also you make sure that these diseases cannot emerge and they are under control. There are species that are regulating them, and the ecosystem itself in its functioning is helping to regulate and keep them under control. It's the same when you think about the marine environment and you think of a harmful algal bloom, for example, if you've heard of toxic algal blooms. These usually happen when there's an imbalance in the marine ecosystem, when there's too many nutrients in the water that fuel this algae to grow, which it's naturally there in the environment. But when you have the right conditions of, for example, very high temperatures combined with pollution, for example, excess nutrients being discharged into the sea, this is where these harmful toxic algal blooms happen, and where you start seeing you know, incidents of diseases or stress on marine species, including fish, sea turtles, etc. So there's always this, we have to, you know, keep in mind the importance of maintaining healthy ecosystems, because it helps maintain that control and that balance that keeps diseases, toxic blooms, or any harmful pathogens under control.
You're so right. Ecosystems are so crucial to maintain and to kind of fortify in a lot of different ways wherever we can. They're basically where we and literally every organism on this planet live. That means that ecosystem restoration is one of the most, you know, top priorities that humans have to consider maintaining. Here we are at a global call to action, right? This is an almost impossible question to answer. But in terms of what's happening, what's being done, and what more can we do, or could be done basically, to restore and conserve our ecosystem?
I think the first priority is to raise awareness. So for people in many fields and across sectors to understand the scale of the challenge that we're facing here and the urgency. I know there's a lot of kind of reports in the media about this, but it doesn't seem to have an impact until it hits home, until you can scale it down to the individual, even to your organization or to you as an individual, and the role that we have. And also provide people with tools on what they can do, not tools as individuals, what you can do as an individual, how can someone contribute, be it through participating in citizen science programs, be it through behavioral change in our daily life, to reduce our impact and our carbon footprint in particular. And there are many guidelines and tools available to help with that. Locally, you know, EAD supports that through the NAHA program, through the SAHEM program, with multiple citizen science and opportunities to get involved in ecosystem monitoring as well as restoration. And then second, at the organizational level, at the level of a business or an entity, there are many certification and partnership programs open to organizations and entities that really want to make an impactful contribution. And one example is the Abu Dhabi Mangrove Initiative Partnership Program. So EAD launched the Abu Dhabi Mangrove Initiative, the ADMI, in 2022 as a way to establish, you know, a hub for successful mangrove restoration that would be pioneering and leading in the region in terms of innovation, science, research, conservation, as well as community engagement. And we've launched this partnership program that is open to any organization, government or non-government, in the UAE to join as a way to contribute to successful ecosystem restoration. And this is done by having projects that are based on scientific data that look at what the sites need locally, that, you know, are done through a systematic approach of assessing the site, understanding the ecology at the site, and then putting in place a strategy to restore the area effectively, as well as a long-term monitoring program. So through the ADMI partnership program, we've been able to really harness this intense interest, this amazing kind of motivation and interest that we see from companies, from businesses, from government entities as well, to support ecosystem conservation and restoration, but also research. And we have amazing partners, including Taqa, Dolphin Energy, ADNOC, and Jubail Island, for example, that have really supported the program and are continuing to support ecosystem restoration in a science-based way. And we continue to work with them to kind of advise on the best approach, because restoration is not easy. It's not as simple as planting trees. It's not a simple landscaping program. It really requires expertise and long-term understanding of the site that you're trying to restore. But also, it's important for us to try and define what are we trying to restore and how do you define success when it comes to habitat restoration? Is it simply by, okay, I've extended the number of trees in the site, or this site is more green, or is it the return of wildlife? Is it restored hydrology? Is it that when we see biodiversity returning at the site, when we see, ecosystem function returning? So this is a question that restoration scientists across the world are still asking. How do you define or put in place measurable indicators or success factors that tell you, all right, you've succeeded in restoring this area? And this is why through these partnership programs that are guided by science and supported and validated by organizations such as EAD, individuals and organizations can effectively contribute to ecosystem restoration. But one thing that I would like to add, that if before we think about restoration, we really need to go back a step and talk about emphasizing protection. So restoration is usually a last case scenario or a last resort. And because it's so difficult to restore something that has been impacted or degraded or lost, nature is nature is incredibly hard to restore when you think about the complexity of and the connections between different habitats and different species. So we really need to prioritize and emphasize protection. And this is, even when it comes to human health, we always say prevention is better than cure. So it's the same when it comes to nature. Protecting an area is a much better policy than, waiting for the area to be impacted and then saying, okay, we might try to restore it. Restoration also takes a long time. And we're talking here decades, a minimum of 10 to 20 years. For desert ecosystems, for example, the restoration process is even slower because it takes a long time and many rainfall events to allow vegetation to regrow. In marine ecosystems, mangroves in particular, which the Abu Dhabi Mangrove Initiative has been focused on, we need a minimum. Yes, you can start seeing trees growing back. You can start seeing signs of natural regeneration, signs that the ecosystem is coming back to life. But really, when you talk about full restoration, it's also within the time frame of 10 to 20 years minimum until you start seeing real results. So protection should be the first priority.
And it should be kind of like a life's work, shouldn't it? I mean, it's much more than a UN directive or government or business. It's like we've got to work inclusively and we need to empower people. It's about making choices. It's a collective effort.
Absolutely, a collective effort and a collective responsibility. And I think the UAE consensus that came out of COP28 was an important message that emphasized that. We have our amazing UAE leaders, including Her Excellency Razan Khalifa Al-Mubarak, the President of the International Union of Conservation of Nature, and also the Managing Director of EAD. She clearly emphasized the importance of collective responsibility and that every sector of society, every individual has a role to play. And it's not just about scientists or ecologists making that effort or, environmental authorities that are responsible for the results, but really society as a whole, businesses. And there are now available tools and guidance on how every sector of society, be it real estate, be it industry, social scientists, in particular economists, what role do we all have in making this change happen, be it behavioral change, but also change in the way we view our world from just, a way to extract resources, but a common collective good that we are all responsible for. And that also helps to maintain our well-being and our health.
You know, I just want to share a personal story. I recently visited the National Aquarium. Have you been there before in the city?
Yeah,
right. I don't know, Tim, if you have, but it's here in Abu Dhabi. And, you know, they take you through the whole, you know, different aquatic systems. They actually start with the regional, I think specifically the UAE, you know, species, etc. But at the very end, if you stick around, they take you through sort of the critical aspects of protecting our environment, protecting our nature. And what is important about turtles, you know, how to deal with them, what are the efforts to protect them, et cetera. And I found that very, very interesting that, that you know, as a you know, member of the public, let's say, to be educated on such an important topic through a fun environment, you know, with the family. You know, I want to tilt slightly in this conversation towards technology. Obviously, you know, we face a lot of technological developments. We have to adapt the newest technology. And, you know, it's incredible what we can see in terms of innovation and technological, you know, advances. I want to take your perspective on how we're leveraging technology in the journey to restore biodiversity and to fight climate change and pollution.
Technology is opening up so many new doors for us in terms of assessing scientific assessments of our habitats. So ultra high resolution satellite imagery that really can give us almost daily, can detect daily changes in our ecosystems, which is an incredible tool for us to really develop responses to protecting these habitats in time before it's too late. But also it's been amazing to see what can be developed to upscale and speed up restoration efforts. So when you think of the traditional way of restoring mangroves has always been, okay, to collect the seeds, grow them in the nursery, after 4 to 6 months, you know, find a good site where you can replant them and wait for them to grow, go back to the site repeatedly. So at that speed and scale, you know, it's quite slow and very labor intensive and time intensive. In Abu Dhabi, we're lucky that, you know, for the first time, we developed this technology together with partners to design a very effective way of dispersing mangrove seeds and in a way that works. So the most important thing about technology is to test it out and then validate it in the field. Because, yes, the concept is one thing. It looks good on paper. It looks interesting. And then when you try it out, this is where, you know, you face the challenge of actually seeing it work out there in the field. And it's especially in very harsh conditions. But in EAD embarked on this challenge with partners since 2020 with custom designed drones that are built out of recyclable materials. And the challenge wasn't just the drone, the design of the drone, or, you know, where to disperse the seeds, but the challenge was to process the seeds and to store them, because mangrove seeds are very challenging in that they don't last very long once you've collected them from the tree. Within 4 days, they have to be planted, or else, you know, you can't use them anymore. So part of that process, in addition to having kind of the custom-built drone to upscale and reach remote areas that we could not reach before on foot for manual restoration or manual planting, you had to find an effective way to make sure that these seeds survive the process and that the drone is equipped and custom built to for the size and the weight of the seeds that you had. So it's really working with engineers, aeronautical engineers as well as GIS specialists that we've been able to test and trial this amazing technology that has helped speed up restoration, but also reduce the cost. And it has helped us reach areas that were very difficult to reach before. And that's just one example. Really, with other technologies that are under development, for example, the key thing has been to speed up and enhance the efficiency in which we survey and monitor our habitats and species. So nowadays, there's automated monitoring. So we're talking either remote sensing through very high-resolution images that can help us detect changes in habitats, but also to monitor growth in habitats that we're trying to restore. And then you also have newly developed technologies that help us to count and detect species remotely, because we know that field surveys are very intensive, very slow, and take a large, an army almost, to be able to cover all the sites. But now with underwater cameras, remotely operated underwater vehicles, you can assess larger areas in less time. And you also have technologies that help process and analyze the data much faster and more efficiently. But the key thing I want to say that all these technologies must be validated by peer-reviewed scientific papers and publications before we deploy them as effective solutions, because there is a risk that we apply a method and the accuracy levels go down, in which case the data or the process is no longer useful to conservation or restoration.
Science first, as always. Nasreen, just a couple more questions for you. Actually, more, I guess, your thoughts, to be honest. How, and this again is one of those hugely kind of rambling general questions, but I'm really interested to hear what you say. How can we best highlight the importance of maintaining ecosystems? We're aware how vital ecosystems are, so that ecologically, economically, culturally, we make sure that we are sustainable.
That's a very big question.
Yeah. It's
how can we as individuals, or we as a society, I guess?
Do you know what I think? I think as a society, concerted efforts come from individuals, pressure on, you know, organizations and governments to do that. I'm interested in your thoughts on what we can do as people, I think.
Yeah. I think the first step, well, I think you only protect what you love. So the first thing is to preach love, love for ecosystems, love for nature, how the important role that nature plays in our daily life, the important role it plays in our children's development, for example. When you think about, you know, how a child that has never been, that doesn't have access to a natural space, that, you know, that space to go out, explore, develop that curiosity, observe, develop that patience to observe nature, you know, and the regulating effect it has on not just on children, but on all of us as humans, you know, the mental health effect of nature. That's really kind of the best place to start, or the most obvious place, because we all know that being in a natural space, you know, be it kayaking in the mangroves, for divers to scuba dive out, for hikers hiking in the mountains, we all know this is an activity that has a deep mental impact on us as human beings. It allows us to survive our daily stressful lives, you know, in this fast-paced world. So I think that's the first step, is to really appreciate that connection, understand it, and then ask the question, okay, what can I change in my daily life, in my behavior? What can I influence to ensure that my impact in terms of carbon footprint, water usage, etc., waste production, how can that be minimized? Because everything we do as humans does have a footprint. But nowadays, there's a lot of options to minimize that. You know, the first step, for example, single-use plastics is a clear one. But then going back within our jobs, you know, our roles in society, to see, okay, in my role in this organization, or my role in this family, what can I do? For someone, for example, that is managing a household, how can I reduce the footprint of my household in terms of waste production, energy usage, etc.? How can I make sure that my family appreciates and learns about nature a bit more? In my organization, you know, what there are, there's now a lot of guidance on natural capital and how that influences a business. And there's particular guidance for specific industries and an initiative called the Science-Based Targets Initiative that helps businesses develop science-based targets that they can implement within their respective industries that can help reduce the carbon footprint of that business, but also help them make a positive, nature-positive transition. By nature-positive, we mean not just impact in terms of overall carbon footprint, but also a positive impact on biodiversity. So it helps organizations understand the dependency they have on nature, and then reduce those dependencies and risks, and in turn, become a nature-positive business or a nature-positive organization. So there's so much we can do, but it really starts with this appreciation and understanding and patience and I think effort to try and learn more about what is going on and about the value of, you know, the way we value nature and the natural world.
Fair enough, Nasreen. And this is really the last question here. From your perspective, can you put into words the importance of the steps that the UAE is taking to ensure ecosystem restoration efforts and to provide a healthy environment for future generations?
The UAE has taken many steps towards, you know, pioneering conservation and restoration. So in particular, you know, having a strengthened regulatory framework, strong environmental laws that go back, you know, more than three decades that have helped put in place the large protected area network that we have today, which is essential to protecting our species and habitats. But also the huge investment and commitment that the UAE has made through global commitments, but also local commitments for studying and conserving natural habitats. And one key amazing program that has enabled all of this within Abu Dhabi Emirate is the habitat mapping project that EAD carried out in 2015 that has been essential to allow us to understand where are our key critical biodiversity hotspots and how can we preserve them? How do we ensure integrated land use planning that allows us to preserve these areas and the multiple ecosystem services and benefits that they provide us with? So we're blessed and lucky to have, you know, to be in a country where nature is valued, regulations can be developed and approved at a speed that is seen nowhere else around the world, and that there is a true commitment and leadership when it comes to environmental stewardship. And you can already see that kind of commitment through you know, through communities and societies, with businesses, you know, that especially with the Abu Dhabi Mangrove Initiative, we are seeing many entities, government or private, approaching us with this interest to really invest in habitat conservation and restoration, you know, wanting further guidance on how to do that and really answering the call for, you know, this need to mobilize resources from across sectors, across industry, and providing this funding and this investment necessary to scale up protection and restoration. So there's multiple efforts happening. And the amazing thing as well that we're seeing is this increased interest in community engagement and citizen science. So we're always receiving multiple calls from volunteers that are reaching out to us, wanting to make a difference, wanting to be out in the field with us, collect data, even in really, really tough environments like mangroves, where you get stuck in the mud. And so it's just seeing that level of interest is a sign of, you know, the importance, according to this, in the UAE.
Nasreen, any guest that comes on this podcast and manages to mention kayaking in the mangroves gets a big thumbs up from Abdulrahman and I. It's been a real pleasure to hear from you. Nasreen Al-Zahlawi is from EAD, the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi. In her day job, she works in marine biodiversity assessment and conservation, terrestrial and marine biodiversity. Nasreen, thank you so much for joining us on Naturally Educated.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Tim and Abdulrahman.
Thank you, Nasreen. Our expert today was Nasreen Al-Zahlawi from EAD.
Do you know, Abdulrahman, we first approached Nasreen to join us on season two of this podcast. It was, that's what, 3 years ago. She was busy at the time. She's still busy now. We had to kind of get hold of her at home. She couldn't come on the show a few years ago. Finally, great to have a chance to talk to her.
Absolutely. It's been such a fun conversation. And you can tell how somebody has the sort of personal attachment to the role that they do. Mm. And her inspiration and where it comes from adds a lot of character to her story.
It really does, actually. What stood out for you? Because I'll tell you what stood out for me. There was a point where she said, and I asked that kind of big rambling question, what's really important? An almost impossible question to answer. And she said, would you mean governments, you know, United Nations directives, or do you mean people? And I thought, well, really, I think people. And she made it really simple. And she said, basically, it starts with an appreciation for nature. when you're in nature, you feel better. You know, there's the old thing of hug a tree and you'll feel great. And, you know, you do. Mm. Or go and kayak in the mangroves with Abdurrahman on a Saturday morning.
Exactly. Let's go. Don't ask me twice.
Absolutely. He's got his kayak on the roof rack and he's away. But it's so true, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, you know, because once you're at that level, you know, it becomes personal. It becomes like I'm contributing to something physical in front of me and I would like to make it better. You know, what I took away from this conversation as well is the, as you mentioned, the mangroves, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that mangrove addresses, you know, multiple domains and multiple factors. It addresses climate change, biodiversity loss, and pollution. It's just this like magical solution that we've talked about multiple times.
Mm, we have. We do kind of have this, I don't know, they're almost mythical now, the mangroves. they are kind of magical, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. I really enjoy that, Tim. In general, it's a topic close to my heart. As I mentioned before, I'm confident, you know, in general about the direction we're going towards. Mm-hmm. And the potential for positive change is huge. And I really do feel like there's a lot that is happening. We're being and doing better.
You know, I think so too. That was a global call to restore and renew ecosystems.
Thanks once again to our expert guest, Nasreen Al-Sahlawi from Environment Agency Abu Dhabi.
That's our episode. I'm Tim Elliott.
And I am Abdurrahman Al-Zaabi. Join us again soon for more Season 5 of EAD's Naturally Educated.